Kuhn Review puts Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @KuhnReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@kuhnreview.com. That is information@cueanderevieww.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 21st of April 2023. Humza Yousaf hits back after Tory peer calls for devolution reverse. This article is written by Abby Garton Crosby. The First Minister has vowed to always defend our democracy after a Tory peer called for Scottish devolution to be reversed. Former Brexit negotiator Lord Frost urged Tory ministers in an article for The Telegraph that if they are re-elected, they should review and roll back some of the currently devolved powers in light of the issues currently facing the SNP. Yousaf hit back at Frost's comments in the Holyrood Chamber and later told The National it was part of a wider pattern from Section 35 to refusing to allow an exemption in the Internal Market Act for the Deposit Return Scheme, of the Tories trying to interfere with Scottish democracy. "We, the Conservative Party and the Conservative Government, have allowed this to happen," Frost wrote. "It's time to fix it. Ministers should make clear that if re-elected, they will review and roll back some currently devolved powers. In particular, Scotland does not need to be an independent actor on the world stage. It should not be able to legislate to disrupt free trade within the UK, and it does not need to have most tax-raising powers currently available to it. These powers are embryonic, independent government powers. They aren't necessary to run an effective local administration, which is what devolution should be about." Frost also said he hoped Labour would do likewise, while dropping its sneaking admiration for socialism in one devolved nation. Asked for his reaction to the comments by Frost, Yousaf told The National, "He of course said the quiet bit out loud. He said what every Scottish Conservative MSP is thinking. They're a party that never supported the creation of this Parliament and want to dismantle devolution. What I would also say is it's part of a wider pattern. We see that of course the UK government wants to curtail the external activity that we do. This is all about undermining devolution. Anyone that believes in devolution should stand up against it." Yousaf was also probed about the comments at the very end of FMQs. He said, "We will always defend our democracy and we will always defend the voice and the will of the Scottish people." Frost's column prompted fury amongst some of the senior Scottish Tories and even led to the party releasing a statement to the press. MSP Murdo Fraser described the comments as nonsense, adding, "Devolution has allowed us to shine a light on SNP failures. The Conservatives will not be rolling it back." Fellow MSP Stephen Kerr tweeted, "Strongly disagree with this article. A poor Scottish government isn't justification to roll back devolution any more than issues at the UK Gov are justification for Scottish separation. Devolution works. It's the SNP that are failing." The party's constitution spokesman, Donald Cameron, added, "What a load of baloney. Devolution hasn't failed, and no Conservative should want to reverse it." The statement from a Scottish Tory spokesperson read, "Lord Frost is a backbench peer and entitled to his personal views. Our view, shared by the UK party, is that the problem is not with devolution, but with this divided and distracted SNP government." That article was written by Abby Garton Crosby. This is from The National on Friday the 21st of April 2023 from the news section. Nigel Farage broadcasts GB News live from Aberdeen. This article is written by Ross Hunter. Nigel Farage has claimed that the independence movement is full of anti-Englishness during a live recording of his GB News programme in Aberdeen. The show opened with a bagpiper before Farage interviewed ALBA Party member and former candidate Charlie Abel. After asking questions about Hamza, mispronounced Yusuf, Farage then asked Abel, as a supporter of independence, how much he disliked the English. After Abel said that he did not dislike the English and that independence had nothing to do with that, Farage said, "A lot of the Scottish nationalist movement has been profoundly anti-English, hasn't it? In a really unpleasant and nasty way." Abel replied, "We have lots of English people in my party and there's nothing anti-English. We are for everybody. Everybody that wants to live in Scotland is welcome in our party, and it doesn't matter where they were born." Farage said he had personally seen some anti-Englishness while visiting Scotland in the past. However, Abel pointed out that that was perhaps more down to his political views rather than his nationality. The GB News presenter then asked if Alex Salmond was past his sell-by date. Abel said, "Absolutely not. He's a young man. He's got plenty to offer the independence movement." After a ripple of laughter from the audience at the suggestion Salmond was young, Abel added, "And if you want to win a fight, you want your best fighter in the ring, and there's no shadow of a doubt he's one of the greatest figures in Scottish politics for the last 100 years. And if I'm on a team, I'd like to have him on my team." Farage said that he didn't doubt for a minute that Salmond was a great scrapper, but pressed Abel over whether the former First Minister's credibility had taken a knock. Abel claimed that there was no issue with his credibility at all. Later in the programme, Farage was asked by an audience member who he would rather have a pint with, Nicola Sturgeon or Alex Salmond. Farage said, "Oh, there's no question about that. I probably shouldn't say this. The times that I've done some debates with Nicola Sturgeon, been face to face with Nicola Sturgeon, walked past Nicola Sturgeon in corridors, I don't think I've met anybody in politics anywhere in the world that I found so personally, deeply arrogant and unpleasant as Nicola Sturgeon." This was greeted with jeers and applause by the small audience inside the pub. The former UKIP leader also shared his opinion on Scottish Government proposals for a minimum income guarantee, which would see everyone in Scotland provided with money from the government to live a dignified quality of life. After an audience member described the proposal as being popular with the work-shy alcoholics and drug users, of which we have plenty already, to laughter from the audience, Farage said, "Under devolution, Scottish finances have become frankly disastrous. What about the aspirants? What about the young people who want to get on in the world? I'm sure that if the late, great Adam Smith were around today, he'd be horrified by this." Following an interview with fellow GB News presenter Neil Oliver, Farage vowed that his programme would return to Scotland before James Cooper of Ballater and District Pipe Band played the bagpipes to end the show. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday the 21st of April 2023, from the news section. Scottish Government announces changes to deposit return scheme. This article is written by Hamish Morrison. The Scottish Government has announced major changes to its controversial recycling scheme after outcry from businesses. Circular Economy Minister Lorna Slater announced 4 key revisions to the Deposit Return Scheme, DRS, just days after the First Minister said he would delay its introduction for nearly a year. Slater defended the scheme as vital to reducing litter on our streets and meeting the country's climate targets. but she conceded the scheme must be delivered in a way that works for businesses, especially for small drinks producers, after the drinks industry raised serious concerns about the project in its previous form. Under the revised plans, bottles, cans and cartons of under 100 millilitres would be excluded, excluding whisky miniatures and other small drinks from the scheme. Also excluded are products which sell fewer than 5,000 units per year, which the government said would particularly benefit craft drinks makers. The government estimated this would remove the need for around 44% of affected drinks businesses to apply a deposit to their products. Hospitality premises which sell most of their drinks for consumption on the premises will be exempt from acting as a return point for empty containers. And the government said that the online application process for retailers to apply for an exemption from acting as a return point had been simplified. The changes are yet to be approved by Parliament, although it is expected they will pass. Slater said, "Scotland's deposit return scheme will reduce litter on our streets, massively increase the recycling of drinks containers, and help meet our net zero ambitions. However, to realise these benefits, DRS needs to be delivered in a way that works for businesses, especially for small drinks producers. The changes I have set out will make the scheme easier for industry to deliver, especially for craft producers, while still making sure the vast majority of drinks containers are captured for recycling. To move forward with certainty, the UK government must stop delaying the long overdue exclusion from the Internal Market Act. This damaging act was imposed on the Scottish Parliament after Brexit, without its consent, and creates confusion and uncertainty for businesses. After that act was passed, we engaged in good faith, following the agreed process, and have done so for nearly 2 years now to agree an exclusion. The UK government needs to, at long last, issue an exclusion and recognise the right of the Scottish Parliament to enact legislation in devolved areas without interference." A UK government spokesperson said, "Ministers only received the formal request for a UK Internal Market Act exclusion for the Scottish Government's deposit return scheme on March 6, 2023. The Scottish Government has since been reviewing and has now paused the scheme, so it has not been possible for us to fully assess the impacts of the exclusion request on cross-UK trade, businesses and consumers. We will continue to engage with the Scottish Government to understand the outcomes of their review and will work together to realise our shared ambition to improve the environment while meeting the needs of consumers and businesses across the UK." That article was written by Hamish Morrison.
From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. Der Spiegel labels UK a nation in crisis as democracy rots away, by Adam Robertson. A leading German news magazine has said that, quotes, "the foundation of Britannia's democracy is literally rotting away," close quotes, in a scathing article on the state of the UK. In a piece titled, "The UK faces a steep climb out of a deep hole," for Der Spiegel, journalist Jörg Schindler discusses how Brexit, poverty levels and Boris Johnson have all contributed to the plight in which Britain finds itself. The journalist described Westminster Palace as being a perfect symbol for the United Kingdom of today. "Here in the low-ceilinged, labyrinthine catacombs, the foundation of Britannia's democracy is literally rotting away, largely out of sight and out of mind. Most of the structure is contaminated by asbestos, while thick tangles of cable hang chaotically from the ceiling and pipes suddenly come to an end, seemingly in the middle of nowhere," Schindler says of Westminster Palace. He adds that the flow of bad news in the UK has been constant, amid a crisis in the NHS and shop closures up and down the high street amid the cost of living crisis. The piece also states that while the number of billionaires in the UK were around 177,
is higher than it has ever been, millions have slipped into poverty. As well as this, it cites statistics which show a dramatic decrease in the UK's gross domestic product before and after Brexit. Although Scotland managed to avoid any strikes in the NHS, the article also discusses how junior doctors in England have taken industrial action, as well as workers in numerous other industries. Since December, hardly a day has passed without a strike by bus drivers, medical workers, teachers, public servants, university employees, or rail workers, the article says. It describes the situation as being akin to a time of high debt and punishing inflation in the 1970s, and cites a quote from former US Secretary Henry Kissinger, who described Britain as a tragedy at that time. The article adds, "One significant reason for that pessimism is the fact that many simply no longer trust their speechifying politicians in Westminster to get much done. The Tory party, which has been in power now for a dozen years, has gone through four prime ministers since 2016 alone." Schindler also is critical of Boris Johnson, who was forced to resign as members of his own government deserted him, saying that he, quote, "still refuses to admit any personal responsibility for the plight in which Britain finds itself," close quotes, as he continues to bleat in a huff from the sidelines. The article ends, "This country was already on its knees before Brexit, before the endless phase of political trench warfare, and before the pandemic. And now it seems as if it has dialed 999 and is waiting in vain for the paramedics to show up." This article was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. Hamza Yousaf meets with Sadiq Khan on trip to London. Hamza Yousaf met with London Mayor Sadiq Khan and EU Ambassador Pedro Serrano in London on Monday. The First Minister also met with the Prime Minister, whom he told to respect the democratic wishes of Scotland and grant a Section 30 order for a second independence referendum. In a post on Twitter, Khan said it was great to welcome Yousaf to City Hall. He added, "At the top of the agenda was tackling the cost of living and how we're rolling out free school meals for primary school children in Scotland and London." The trip marks Yousaf's first visit to London since winning the SNP leadership election, and he pressed the PM on numerous issues, including the Foreign Secretary's demands that Scotland's diplomatic efforts abroad be carefully observed by UK officials. In a separate tweet, Yousaf also said he held a meeting with Serrano to discuss the Scottish Government's close ties with the EU and our European neighbours based on shared values like democracy, equality and respect for human rights. Writing on his own social media meanwhile, Serrano said he was honoured to have met with Yousaf and that they had discussed topics of common interest, including EU citizens living in Scotland. During his meeting with Sunak, Yousaf also raised Lord Frost's comments about reversing devolution. He also said that he started his meeting with the PM by asking for a briefing on Sudan. "I was grateful for the information provided and his agreement to keep at ScotGov updated on developments. I wish the military and all of those involved in the evacuation well," Yousaf said on Twitter. Elsewhere, speaking to the BBC after the meeting, the First Minister has said that finding auditors to process the SNP accounts in time to meet a key deadline at the end of May will be challenging. He said he is going to work towards meeting the deadline and that there is the ability to ask for an extension if it is needed, but that the party is not in that space yet. That article was by Adam Roberts. From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. Loch Lomond attraction wins best in UK after being judged by tourists. By Tempany Grace. A cruise based on Loch Lomond has been recognised as the best in the UK in a national award. Cruise Loch Lomond has been rated the best overall loch cruise in the UK by more than 10,000 tourists. The award was given by Irish coach tour operator CIE Tours, which recognises the quality of the UK's hotels and visitor attractions by giving an award of excellence to those who have received a greater than 90% customer satisfaction rating over the previous year. The company gives special recognition to the best performing tourism provider in 12 categories. Since the 1990s, CIE Tours offerings have included Scotland and the rest of the UK, with combination tours of Scotland, UK and Ireland becoming some of the most popular in recent years. In 2022, demands for combined tours of Scotland and Ireland exceeded other destinations, reaching 2019 levels, and 2023 is already on course to exceed this benchmark. Stephen Cotter, Chief Operations Officer of CIE Tours, said, "We are delighted to report a strong recovery in our Scottish and UK tours since international travel reopened following the pandemic. I want to acknowledge the resilience of our tourism partners who, having had a very difficult few years, enthusiastically welcomed back our visitors once restrictions were lifted. Their professionalism is reflected in the feedback from our visitors, with overall satisfaction levels in 2022 only slightly less than 2019, despite a very challenging year for travel. We were encouraged by the pipeline of bookings for the coming year, particularly in Scotland, which are ahead of expectations, and we look forward to ensuring that our partners and our host communities continue to benefit from our success in attracting visitors to travel to Scotland and the rest of the UK." This article was by Tempany Grace. From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. Loganair to launch new route from Aberdeen Airport, by Adam Robertson. A Scottish airline will launch a new route from Aberdeen Airport next month. Glasgow-based Loganair is to operate a new service between Scotland and Southampton. The daily service will operate via Newcastle Airport, and customers travelling to England's south coast will not need to leave the airport on the one-stop flight. Aberdeen Airport said that the success of Loganair's summer 2022 season led the airline to expand services across its network in 2023. Group Head of Airline Relations and Marketing for Aberdeen International Airport, Christopher Tibbett, said the introduction of this one-stop service to Southampton via Newcastle is fantastic news. "I'm sure our passengers will take advantage of connectivity this route will provide from next May." It comes after Loganair said it will also expand its presence at Heathrow, having secured 30 additional pairs of slots each week under a lease arrangement with British Airways. This means the Scottish airline will be able to develop connections with regional airports and the UK's biggest international hub. Loganair also previously announced it would commence flights on a new route between Orkney and London City Airport. The Orkney to Edinburgh service is set to be restored to pre-pandemic levels as part of its plans for the summer. Flights between Donegal and Glasgow will also be available again from July. This article is by Adam Robertson.
From The National of Tuesday, the 25th of April 2023, from the comment section, "Scotland must stand its ground in culture wars," by Karen Adam, columnist. "It is becoming increasingly evident that the culture wars triggered by right-wing groups in America are more apparent and visible here now than I have ever seen in my lifetime. It could be that in our internet age, the world has become a smaller place. Connections are more easily made and communications between countries take seconds. When we see a movement in the US, it's usually not long before the hyped-up headlines start running across our social media here. The latest attacks against drag performances is something that is so absurd to me. Drag is something we have loved and lived with, enjoyed and accepted as part of our own culture and history. To see this now be used as another dig at any non-conforming gender expression is an attack on our liberties and our arts. As an Elvis fan, I have often pondered the reaction to his hair, clothing and his dance movements when he rose to stardom. He was banned from dancing and only filmed from the waist up on TV shows. He was branded a pervert and a work of the devil. David Bowie was certainly a curiosity for many. Ditto Mark Bolan and women like Annie Lennox. She was called a gender bender in the press for not looking or dressing like a stereotypical woman. She took to the stage at the Grammys, dressed as Elvis, to double down and push back against these tropes. It's a time for reflection on our drag acts, as within 1 month we have had the passing of two of the most iconic drag artists of modern times. Paul O'Grady and Barry Humphries were legendary performers, creating characters that were so convincing you could easily forget that they weren't people in their own right. I was first aware of Humphrey's act Dame Edna Everage when I was a young girl. I would stay up late at a weekend to watch her. I would just love the energy she would exude and mostly the laughs she brought into my living room. Her humour would mostly go over my head, but some jokes would land, and as I matured, the humour only got better as my understanding grew. Her satirical ways ensured that many a hypocrisy was picked up in political and institutional circles. She was the walking embodiment of snobbery and judgment, and she did that so it could be laughed at for the odious traits they are. O'Grady's Lily Savage character was one of my favourite artists, and the fact she came from gay bars to mainstream Saturday night TV and then weekday daytime TV is a credit to hard work and a resolve to make drag something we could all enjoy. To make that connection to LGBT people, their history and culture, straight to mainstream TV did a lot to reduce stigmas, which were still prevalent along with Section 28. The LGBT community had suffered terrible stigma during the 1980s and 90s, and Lily's work, which took many years of garnering trust, will be wiped away in months if we don't reject the current right-wing culture war tropes. Tennessee was the first US state to restrict drag performers with a law that prohibits, quotes, adult and cabaret performances in public or in the presence of children. Another step forward from the right-wing conservative anti-LGBT agenda is to tag perversion onto anything that doesn't conform to their views and beliefs. And many other states are aiming to create similar laws. With the recent state bans on abortion after Roe v. Wade was overturned, I genuinely fear for US citizens on what the future holds. But all I and others can do is stand up and reject the reactive nonsense before it takes a firm hold here. We have seen here recently already the exaggerated attempts by right-wing activists to gain media coverage of their concern about drag acts by protesting a drag queen story time at a pub that wasn't even happening. All this hyperbole, thinly veiled by their bigoted views, was an attempt for this to pick up momentum here. A few years ago, I had friends visiting from America who attended a pantomime. After the show, they voiced their shock at the humour and the panto dame being a man in women's clothing. So I do recognise cultural differences between us and America, and I also accept things must move with the times. But pantomime is something that is embedded in our history. With our panto dame being the main character of the show, we can see that drag is not a modern concept. It was born from artistic performances way back in history. The humour can be innuendo targeted at the adults attending and meant to go way over the heads of the children, though over the years this has changed as writers and appropriate guidance has been more informed. Audience expectations change. If we did see the banning of cross-dressing performers enacted here like in America, we would see the end of pantomime. Can you see how absurd an idea this is? We have a long tradition of performing arts where people have portrayed the opposite gender. The acts have often been protests in themselves to carry messages of a political nature through satire or to add humour to testing times. When the gay bar Lily Savage was performing in had a police raid, which was common in the 80s with the culture war against gay people, homophobia being rife, the police wore rubber gloves, as they were so ignorant as to what HIV was, and these were supposedly to protect them from HIV. Lily quipped down the mic, "Well, well, looks like we've got help with the washing up." In the most intense and brutal times, the character used her humour as a form of utter defiance. She didn't let them grind her down. I sincerely hope that whatever the future holds for us and our nation, that we are always wise to those who seek to impose their agenda on our long-established and cherished cultures. This article was by Karen Adam.
From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. SNP's John Mason likely to stand down at Holyrood election, by James Walker. SNP backbencher John Mason has said he is almost certain to step down at the next Holyrood election in 2026. Speaking to Holyrood magazine, the MSP for Glasgow Shettleston said he was 90 to 95% sure. He added, "I am 65 now. I'll be 68 at the next election. I think that may be time to retire. I'm almost certain." Mason also defended his controversial statements on abortion. On Saturday, he was photographed participating in an anti-abortion protest in Edinburgh. Pictures were posted online of the MSP, and calls for the removal of the whip also shared. In March, Labour's Monica Lennon also accused him of hijacking the Baby Loss Memorial book unveiled by Nicola Sturgeon for those who have experienced a pregnancy or baby loss prior to 24 weeks. At the time, Mason submitted a parliamentary motion, which was blasted by the way in which the motion appeared to play down the pain women suffer when losing a baby at the early stages of pregnancy. Mason also said in the interview, "We were making a commemoration for babies under 24 weeks whose parents wanted them and had had a miscarriage or stillbirth. When, on the other hand, if I said in an abortion debate that a baby under 24 weeks was a baby, I will be shouted down and told that I shouldn't even call it that. I'm not afraid of getting a reaction. I just feel on some of these subjects somebody has to speak out, although I would rather it was a woman speaking." This article was by James Walker. From The National, Tuesday the 25th of April 2023, from the news section. Woman woke to find naked man beside her in train, by Adam Robertson. British Transport Police, BTP, is appealing for information after a woman woke to find a naked man sitting next to her after she fell asleep on a train. It is treating the incident as public indecency and is appealing for help to trace the man. The woman was on a train travelling between Polmont and Edinburgh Waverley when she fell asleep at 7:21 a.m. on April the 20th. When she woke up, a man was sitting next to her, naked. He later put on jogging bottoms and a t-shirt before leaving the train at Edinburgh Waverley. The man is described as white, of medium or slim build, aged 65 to 70, 5'6" tall, with short grey hair and a stubbly beard. He was wearing black joggers, a black t-shirt and black walking boots. Anyone with information is asked to contact BTP by calling 0800 40 50 40 or by texting 61016 with reference 23000440058 or Crime Stoppers 0800 555 111 where anonymity can be maintained. This article was by Adam Roberts.
The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Donald Trump to visit Scotland next week as the former president faces charges in the United States. An article written by Andrew Smart. Donald Trump is coming to Scotland next week to visit his Ayrshire golf course. The former president is expected to spend time at his Turnberry course, according to reports from PA News. The 76-year-old business tycoon and former United States leader will also stop off in Ireland, weeks after his political rival and sitting president Joe Biden visited the country. He's expected to stay at his Trump International Hotel and Golf Links near Doonbeg in County Clare. The visit comes as Mr. Trump faces court action amid rumours he's running for high office again in 2024. Mr. Trump previously visited Scotland in July 2018 while in office. He spent 2 days at his Turnberry resort with his wife Melania as part of a 4-day trip to the United Kingdom, during which he met the then Prime Minister Theresa May and the Queen. He faced widespread protests and was heckled as he played golf at Turnberry with his son Eric. During his campaign for the White House in 2016, he visited Scotland the day after the EU referendum and praised the United Kingdom for voting to leave. Mr. Trump has been accused of different instances of making hush money payments to cover up affairs. All 34 charges relate to $130,000 paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels to stop her from talking about her allegation that she had had an affair with Mr. Trump. He's pleaded not guilty to charges of falsifying business records to hide damaging information ahead of the 2016 presidential election. An article written by Andrew Smart. The National, Politics, on Wednesday, the 26th of April. First Minister blocks refunds for independence donations. An article written by Jane McLeod. SNP supporters who donated cash to the party for campaigning in a second independence referendum will not have their money returned to them if no such ballot takes place, Hamza Yousaf has said. The First Minister told LBC that he had not spoken to his predecessor Nicola Sturgeon since her husband was arrested, but said he wanted to check in with her during what will have been a difficult period. Mr. Yousaf told LBC's Tonight with Andrew Marr programme that with the police investigation into the party's finances taking place, it would be very dangerous for him to comment. But he stated, about money that is raised from the membership by the party, we're going to spend that in advancing the cause of an independence referendum. We're not reimbursing people for the donations that they have made. People make donations to the party because they want to advance the cause of independence. Every pound and penny that we spend as a party will be on advancing the cause of independence. He insisted he hoped to have many successes as First Minister, pledging that tackling child poverty would be his government's defining mission. But he stated if he had not achieved independence as an SNP First Minister, by the time he leaves the job, that will be one failure. He raised the issue of a Section 30 order granting the Scottish Government power to hold an independence referendum in his first face-to-face meeting with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak on Monday evening. Mr. Yousaf also made clear that this would be the first demand the SNP would make to support Labour in power at Westminster if Sir Keir Starmer's party fails to achieve an overall majority in the next UK election. Mr. Yousaf said the SNP would certainly be willing to cooperate with a Labour government because we want to see the back of the Tories. But he added, of course, that would come at a cost. And of course, the first demand I would make would be to get powers over a Section 30 order and having that devolved to Scotland. Mr. Yousaf continued, if there is a hung parliament, then of course we'll cooperate. I'll say that unequivocally. We'll cooperate with anybody that is a progressive political party and that's looking to see the back of the Tories, but there will be a price. Meanwhile, the First Minister said he did not think Donald Trump would be rushing to meet with me when he comes to Scotland next week. The former US President is expected to spend some time at his golf resort, Trump Turnberry, in South Ayrshire. Mr. Yousaf accepted he had a duty as a First Minister, of course, to meet other Prime Ministers, Presidents and Heads of State. However, regarding Mr. Trump, he admitted that I don't think he'll be rushing to meet with me. He condemned the anti-Muslim rhetoric that I've heard from Donald Trump, with Mr. Yusuf adding he had been particularly aggrieved and angered by some of the language used against London's own mayor, Sadiq Khan, at the time when he was president. As a result, he said, I would find it difficult, I have to say, to meet with him without raising the significance of concerns I have of the remarks that he's made in the past. An article written by Jane McLeod. The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Food bank figures shame the Tories. An article written by James Walker. The number of emergency food parcels going to struggling households across the UK has reached an all-time high, according to a leading food bank charity. The figures, published by the Trussell Trust, found that a record total of 2,986,203 parcels were given to people in the UK in the past year, with over a million going to children alone. A record 259,744 emergency food parcels were also provided to struggling Scots, according to the charity. The SNP's social justice spokesperson, David Lyndon, said the figures laid bare the impact of Tory rule over Scotland and the damage being done to the Scottish Government's efforts to eradicate poverty. The Trussell Trust, which supports a network of more than 1,200 food banks in the UK, said this was a 30% increase in Scotland compared to the same period last year. Alarmingly, they added that the number of parcels provided is 50% higher than the amount distributed by food banks in the Trussell Trust network in Scotland 5 years ago. The annual statistics also indicate that an increasing number of people are struggling to afford the essentials, with more than 62,000 people in Scotland using one of the 138 Trussell Trust food bank centres for the first time. This is more people than can fit into Hampden Park. Shona Singer, a project manager at a food bank in Aberdeenshire, said, "These cases are no longer rare or isolated, and there are far too many who do not have enough to cover the essentials. We're seeing more and more people forced into debt to heat their homes and feed their families. And that's why universal credit must cover the essentials at the bare minimum to help us end the need for food banks in Scotland." Speaking about the rising need for emergency food, Polly Jones, head of Scotland at the Trussell Trust, said, "These new statistics are extremely concerning and show that an increasing number of people are being left with no option but to turn to charitable, volunteer-run organisations to get by, and this is not right." She also suggested that the extension of eligibility for the Scottish Child Payment from age 6 to age 16 and the £5 uplift to £25 a week that was introduced in November has made an impact. She added, however, that further and immediate action needed to be taken by the Scottish Government. Mr. Lyndon doubled down in condemning the Tory government. He said, "The Tories' cost of living crisis, compounded by their bad Brexit, supported by their chums in the Labour Party, has driven up prices and forced a record amount of people to rely on food banks. These figures ought to shame even the most hard-line Conservatives into immediate action, demonstrating that Tory austerity and economic policy has completely failed. They sum up the legacy of this shameful Tory government, which continues to cause untold harm to ordinary people in Scotland who didn't elect them." He added, "In Scotland, we've taken steps to eradicate poverty and mitigate the worst of Tory rule. But here we're being made to watch powerless yet again as that work is undone by Westminster. While we introduced groundbreaking new benefits, the Tories were busy slashing universal credit and hiking taxes on the lowest earners. People in Scotland need an escape from the austerity and cost of living crisis created by Westminster that will only come with the full powers of independence." An article written by James Walker. The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Landmark legislation published to scrap not proven verdict. An article written by Abby Garton-Crosby. Landmark legislation to scrap Scotland's not proven verdict and make a number of changes to the justice system has been published. The Victims, Witnesses and Justice Reform Scotland Bill will also change the size of criminal juries from 15 to 12. It aims to address a number of issues around serious sexual offences, creating a new specialist sexual offences court. Ministers will also have the power to carry out a pilot of rape trials being conducted by a single judge without a jury. For jury trials, the majority needed for a guilty verdict will be at least two-thirds. The legislation will also guarantee an automatic right to state-funded independent legal representation for complainers when applications are made by the defence to lead evidence on their sexual history or bad character in sexual offence cases. Last year, Nicola Sturgeon committed to abolishing the third verdict in the Scottish legal system. Discussions around Scotland's third verdict, which has the effect of acquitting the accused, have been going on for years. The verdict is unique to Scots law, and there is no equivalent in other jurisdictions. Justice Secretary Angela Constance said, "This bill will put victims and witnesses at the heart of the justice system. It's testament to the efforts of many campaigners who have worked to ensure that the processes of justice better serve victims, witnesses and vulnerable parties. This landmark legislation is among the most significant since devolution and will ensure fairness is cemented into the bedrock of Scotland's modern-day justice system. Building on the experiences of survivors, victims and their families, these key reforms will make justice services more sensitive to the trauma it can cause. This government has been clear we must take action to improve the experience of those who suffer sexual abuse. The majority are women, who must be supported to have trust and confidence that the processes of justice will serve their needs, allow them to give their best evidence and support them in their recovery." She also hailed the creation of a new independent commissioner for victims and witnesses. Earlier, the chief executive of Rape Crisis Scotland welcomed plan to scrap the not proven verdict, saying she has no doubt that guilty men are walking free. Speaking to the BBC's Good Morning Scotland programme, Sandy Brindley said the changes were a really positive development. However, advocate Thomas Ross, KC, took the opposite view, saying jurors should be trusted to carry out the job they've been given. He told the programme, "I work with prosecutors every day. I don't hear them saying that they're concerned about the conviction rate. I hear it every time Sandy's invited to come on one of these programmes." Previously, the Law Society had warned there could be an increase in miscarriages of justice if not proven is scrapped as a verdict. According to Rape Crisis, not proven is used disproportionately in rape cases in Scottish courts. In 2019-2020, only 43.4% of rape and attempted rape cases resulted in convictions, while not proven made up 44% of acquittals for rape and attempted rape cases. This is compared with only 20% of not proven verdicts for all crimes and offences. An article written by Abby Garton Crosby. The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. More than 400 suspected drug deaths in Scotland in 4 months. An article written by James Walker. More than 400 suspected drug deaths were recorded between November and February, figures show. Statistics released by Public Health Scotland, reported based on initial investigations by Police Scotland, show an average of 96 suspected deaths every month between December and February, the same figure recorded in the same period the year before. A total of 116 deaths were recorded in November, 93 in December, 108 in January and 86 in February, according to the Rapid Action Drug Alerts and Response System, totalling 403 during the period. The average weekly number of suspected deaths sat at 22, lower than the same period in 2020-2021 when it was 33 and around the same level as the previous year. Scottish Liberal Democrat leader Alex Cole-Hamilton said the figures show that Scotland's drug death catastrophe continues to rumble on. He added, the Scottish Government has made a series of grand proclamations, but it's still struggling to make a dent in drugs deaths. Scottish Liberal Democrats are calling for the immediate introduction of specialist drug commissions, the decriminalisation of drug misuse, and for safe consumption spaces to be available across the country. The Scottish Government needs to offer families more than cheap talk. An article written by James Walker. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 26th of April. Nicola Sturgeon speaks publicly about the nightmare of the police probe for the first time as she makes a return to Holyrood. A front page article written by Laura Pollock and Judith Duffy. An emotional Nicola Sturgeon said yesterday that she could not have anticipated the events the SNP has faced during the police investigation into their finances in her worst nightmares. With her former Deputy First Minister John Swinney by her side as she returned to Holyrood, the former First Minister spoke to the media for the first time since her husband Peter Murrell was arrested as part of the police investigation into the party's finances. The party's treasurer, Colin Beattie, who has since stepped down, was arrested last week in the same police probe, then also released without charge pending further investigation. Ms Sturgeon told journalists there are many questions she wants to be able to answer, but that she was not going to go into any details that would impinge on the police investigation. When asked if this was her worst nightmare, she said, "The last few weeks have been very, very difficult, and I don't think anybody would believe me if I said anything other than that. I'm not saying that for sympathy, it's what it is. Clearly, the events of the last few weeks have been difficult, and I use this word advisedly and deliberately, traumatic." She added, "I've had many difficult periods in a political career that has lasted over several decades, and I think you can safely say that the last few weeks have been amongst the most difficult. But it is what it is, and I accept that. I hope to be able to put a counter to many of the things that have been said right now." Regarding the investigation, the former First Minister said that she had not been questioned by police, and when asked if she was expected to be, said she was not going to get into any aspect of the investigation. She added, "One of the frustrating aspects of that is that I'm not able to get my version of what's going on just now. Hopefully the time will come when I can do that." Ms Sturgeon also again denied the police investigation had anything to do with her resignation in February. She said, "I understand the view that some people might have, that I knew this was all about to unfold and that's why I walked away. Nothing could be further from the truth. I would not have anticipated in my worst nightmares what would have unfolded over the past few weeks." Asked if she was surprised when the police arrived on her doorstep to search her home, she said, "I think you can probably take the answer to that as yes." On the motorhome, which was confiscated from the home of former SNP chief Peter Murrell's mother, Ms Sturgeon said she was not going to get into anything that is subject to police investigation. Earlier, Mr Beattie said he was not aware of the purchase of the vehicle. He later clarified that comment by saying, "I was unaware of the transaction at the time of purchase. I became aware of the transaction via the 2021 annual accounts." On the issue of the SNP's auditors resigning, Ms Sturgeon said, "The auditors stepped down from representing the SNP not because of the police investigation, but as part of a review of their own business, and a process was underway to appoint new auditors. So while people are seeing that now through the prism of recent events, at the time there was nothing untoward in that process of appointing new auditors." Despite the police investigation, the former First Minister said the party is in good shape. Ms Sturgeon said, "I believe the SNP, notwithstanding the real difficulties that surrounds the party just now, is in good shape, and I think Humza will take it to an even better place." Ms Sturgeon added that she'd not spoken to Mr Yusuf since her husband's arrest, but that he's doing an outstanding job as First Minister, and he continues to have my support, and that she would speak to Humza in due course. Ms Sturgeon's comments come hours after Mr Beattie spoke to journalists at Holyrood for the first time since his arrest last week. Mr Beattie denied that the SNP is in financial difficulty, insisting the SNP is in the black. Asked if the party is not going bust, Mr. Beattie said, "We're a going concern, definitely." The MSP was also asked if his arrest was the worst thing which has ever happened to him. He replied, "No, I was in Beirut, actually, when I was under artillery fire. That was worse." A front page article written by Laura Pollock and Judith Duffy. The National, on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Opinion. Diane Abbott's mistake turned racism into a bleak contest. A column written by Asa Samake Roman. Racists were having a hell of a day on Sunday. They were allowed to engage in their favourite pastime, inverting the roles and accusing those who oppose racism of being the real racists. It appears that this is the time we're in, as equality activists and advocates must now give evidence that they are not secret bigots. Of course, it's unfortunate, to put it mildly, that Diane Abbott, Britain's first black female MP with a parliamentary career spanning more than 30 years, and one of the nation's most outspoken activists on racial issues, human rights and civil liberties, penned an ill-advised letter to The Observer last weekend that caused an enormous rift in the Labour Party and gave reactionaries a prime opportunity to start a pile-on. The hurt and anger she caused with her letter is entirely understandable, and she agrees with this, as she immediately apologised effusively and unreservedly and distanced herself from her own words. All serious people agree on this. You can't equate the prejudice against redheads and the hatred endured by Jewish people and the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller communities. We shouldn't minimise the violence that these communities have experienced during centuries like this. It's incredibly offensive. Ms. Abbott's 36-year tenure as an MP has been marred by an appalling amount of racist and sexist abuse, a fact that should never be forgotten. Startling research by Amnesty International revealed that an alarming 43% of all abusive tweets sent to female MPs leading up to the 2017 general election were directed at her alone. As an independent MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, following the suspension of the Labour whip, she has time and time again bravely and honestly spoken out about the relentless threats she faced on social media every single day. "I bet it must have escalated since Sunday. She made a terrible mistake, that is undeniable. But does it justify the sheer witch hunt that ensued, especially after her apology?" Many public figures have expressed their discomfort at this sorry spectacle, such as journalist Robert Peston and Tony Blair's former political secretary John McTiernan, who wondered in a Spectator column why we found it so hard to accept an apology. That being said, I don't really see why there needed to be an argument against Tomiwa Owolade, the journalist who wrote the piece to which Ms. Abbott reacted. Her point was very simple. Racism is not something only black people have to endure. Other groups are facing hatred, including Gypsy, Traveller and Roma communities, and Jewish people. We all understand that we live in a racist society. Anyone who disagrees with this is misguided and perpetuating racism. Any form of racial discrimination against anyone is morally repugnant, and civic society has a moral obligation to combat prejudice. We should make every effort to eradicate racism in our society. Racism can take many different forms, thus my experience of it will be very different from other people's. Despite my best efforts, I will never be able to comprehend what it's like to be Jewish. I'll even go so far as to state that, as a black woman, my experience is very different from that of other black people who live in Scotland. Why? Because race is a social construct, and depending on the time and place, different people will interpret and experience it differently. Compared to other black people in Scotland, my experience with racism is completely different. Since no one has ever really mentioned the colour of my skin since I've lived here, I feel, weirdly, like my Frenchness is coming before my blackness. In contrast, I experienced severe abuse and was the target of clichés in France, not just in school, but even in my adult life. In some places, my husband, who is white, and I have attracted interrogative looks from people as we stroll together. And in journalism, I've faced questions about why I wanted to live in Scotland and write about Scotland rather than write about Africa. Yes, really. I've written a little about Africa in my young career, but it shocked some editors and senior journalists to learn that my career goals were unrelated to the amount of melanin in my skin. It never implies that I don't care about the lived experiences of other individuals and groups when I draw attention to these particular issues I face as a black woman. The so-called oppression Olympics don't interest me. Racism is abhorrent. It must be opposed and expunged from society. And there's no doubt that we must work together to accomplish this, point blank. Sometimes I feel the conversation about racism can turn out as a bleak contest, where people fight each other to prove that their pain is greater than that of others, as if we needed a hierarchy and to prioritise fights. In fact, it's entirely possible to care about the various forms of racism and the unique obstacles they present. Recognising and appreciating one another's experiences, not just regarding race, but also social class, gender, sexuality and disability doesn't negate our own. Out of all this furore, I hope that what we take away is that we need to fight against all forms of hatred together. This is eloquently argued by Ilana Weitzman, a socialist and feminist activist who I discovered a few years ago thanks to her writing on postpartum, the period that starts from the birth of a newborn baby, which really opened my eyes and encouraged me to educate myself on what would happen to my body and my mental health when becoming a new parent. Her latest book, Whites Like the Others, The Jews, the Blind Spot of Anti-Racism, is a manifesto for the convergence of all anti-racist struggles. Our common enemy is white supremacy, whether you're Jewish, Muslim or black, she says in an interview. When you're racialized, attacking the recognition of Jewish suffering means attacking yourself. Nobody is a winner in the game of who is the one who has suffered the most. This is the biggest knot in anti-racist struggles. Getting out of the competition is the first condition for us to be able to move forward together and fight against a system that crushes us all. A column written by Asa Samake Roman. The National, on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Opinion. The double standards are on full display. A column written by the Wijinja Doug. The anti-independence parties, you know, those parties which loudly demanded transparency from the SNP and insisted that they needed to publish their membership figures in the name of public trust, have all refused to release their membership figures. The branch offices of Labour, the Conservatives and the Lib Dems in Scotland have all rebuffed calls to reveal just how many members they have in Scotland. Yet again, we see the apologists for Westminster demanding that the SNP is held to a far higher standard than they consent to be held to themselves. It's all part of a well-established pattern of British nationalist double standards. During the SNP leadership election, the deputy leader of Labour in Scotland, Jackie Bailey, demanded that the SNP demonstrate real transparency and openness. But she apparently does not believe that that need for real transparency and openness extends to her own party. It's not transparency that Ms. Bailey and Douglas Ross want. It's a one-way mirror which allows them to peer into the inner working of their pro-independence opponents, all the better to point an accusing finger, while their own parties remain shrouded in a cloak of secrecy which the majority of the Scottish media has no interest in penetrating. The reluctance of the anti-independence parties to let the totals of their Scottish membership be known is not unconnected to the fact that the Scottish membership of both Labour and the Tories is almost certainly less than 10% of the 74,889 members the SNP reported this week, up from the 72,186 reported at the beginning of March. Meanwhile, it's not at all implausible that the total membership of the Lib Dems in Scotland is less than the 2,703 members that the SNP has gained since March. Of the other parties at Holyrood, only the Scottish Greens have published their membership figures, with 7,646 members as of Monday this week. It's understood that the ALBA party has in the region of 7,000 members, but they too have yet to publish an exact figure. ALBA have said they will provide up-to-date figures at the party's spring conference next month. Talking of double standards, you need to have been living in a cave to have missed the Scottish media's obsessive coverage of the delays and cost overruns to the replacement ferries. But if you blinked, you would easily have missed that same media's coverage of the £3 billion Royal Navy aircraft carrier HMS Prince of Wales. It was built at Rosyth Dockyard between 2011 and 2019 and had been expected to be ready for frontline duties in the Royal Navy by 2023. However, the vessel is still not ready for service, having broken down in August 2022, less than 24 hours into a planned voyage to the United States. Now, parts of the ship are to be scavenged in order to replace broken parts on her equally unreliable and expensive sister ship, the HMS Queen Elizabeth. Of course, this expensive mess produced by a shipyard in Scotland has not received a fraction of the attention from the Scottish media, which was and is devoted to the ferries, despite the fact that the cost to the public purse is far greater. Cynical observers might note that this is because it's Westminster's mess, and the Scottish media will do their best to minimise it until such time as an angle can be found that allows blame to be heaped on the Scottish Government. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Police Scotland spent £15.4 million on the Queen's funeral. An article written by James Walker. Police Scotland spent more than £15 million on the Queen's funeral last year, it has been revealed. An investigation by National World found that UK emergency services spent at least £75 million, according to the Home Office. They did not disclose what this was spent on. SNP MP Anne McLaughlin said the revelation rendered her speechless and called this level of spending immoral. It comes as the country prepares for the coronation of King Charles on May the 6th. Police Scotland's operational costs came to £15.4 million alone, according to a report from a Scottish Police Authority Resources Committee meeting. After the Queen's death at Balmoral Castle, a coffin was transported to Edinburgh to lie in state at St Giles Cathedral for 24 hours, which drew crowds of thousands. The force said its costs had been covered in full by His Majesty's Treasury. It's unclear, however, if Police Scotland's expenditure is included in the Home Office's £75 million figure, as policing is a devolved matter. Ms McLaughlin, the SNP MP for Glasgow North East, said she was struggling to find the words to respond to this news. She added, "I understand we currently live in a system where we have a royal family, and of course security is very important. But even the most ardent royalist must see that using £75 million of taxpayers' money on this, especially at the height of a crisis where people are literally having to choose between heating and eating, and children are going to school hungry, is immoral. King Charles is said to have private wealth of almost £2 billion. Let that sink in. We're being taken for fools. Worse, we are teaching our children that maintaining this one family is more important than their hunger or their well-being." Campaign group Our Republic also blasted the spending. A spokesperson said, "The funeral, just like the coronation, is not a state occasion. In a normal modern state, it would have been an opportunity for a family to privately grieve a loved one. Instead, millions were spent parading a woman forced by the nature of her role into performing it until her death, for a public that is losing faith that her role even mattered. Now we face the morbid fact of a son elevated to an unaccountable seat of power by his mother's death, championed by a farcical demonstration of the extreme wealth he enjoys, yet still expects the public to pay to witness paraded before them." an obscene expense that could easily have been paid for on the proceeds of his inheritance tax alone, if he weren't exempt from it. If he weren't allowed to keep his billions untouched so he could wave his gilded pomp in the faces of the millions suffering from the cost of living crisis he could never experience or understand. An article written by James Walker. The National, Politics, on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Section 35 court case, a watershed moment for Scottish devolution. An article written by Abby Garton Crosby. The way that the Section 35 dispute between the Scottish and UK governments is resolved could represent a watershed moment in the history of devolution, constitutional experts have said. Public law experts Chris McCorkindale and Aileen McHarg, writing for the UK Constitutional Law Association, said that they hoped judges presiding over the case would be alive to the dangers to Scottish democracy when reaching their conclusions. Earlier this month, Social Justice Secretary Shirley-Ann Somerville confirmed that Westminster's decision to stop the Gender Recognition Reform Scotland Bill from receiving royal assent would be challenged in court. In January, Scottish Secretary Alistair Jack laid down a Section 35 order to stop the reforms from becoming law, despite the legislation being voted through Holyrood by a majority of MSPs and with cross-party support. And now, constitutional experts have analysed what the process will look like, the background to the challenge, and what issues may arise in a lengthy paper. Released on Tuesday, it concludes that it will be many months before the fate of the gender reforms is decided, with the appeal likely to go all the way to the Supreme Court. As a Section 35 order has not been used before, it means there is considerable uncertainty about how legal issues will be decided, and they warned further issues could arise during the process, particularly if it reveals details of how the Scottish Secretary reached his decision to use the veto. Mr. McCorkindale and Ms. McHarg concluded that if the Section 35 order survives the appeal, the Scottish Government would take consolation from a judicial approach that favours a narrow interpretation of the power, provides for a high standard of review to be applied to its exercise, and imposes an onerous interpretation of the duty to give reasons. However, a judicial approach allowing for a broader interpretation of powers, a higher threshold for judicial intervention on reasonableness grounds, or a light-touch approach to the reasons given by Westminster might encourage the UK government to use a Section 35 more frequently. This could be through the UK weaponising the order to encourage changes to Scottish legislation during the early stages of scrutiny or as the bill passes through Holyrood. Indeed, the way in which this dispute is resolved could well represent a watershed moment in the history of devolution, they wrote. The bill has been remarkable for the extent to which opponents have sought to make use of the arguments about devolved competence throughout the legislative process, and of the opportunities that the devolution legislation affords for forum shifting from the Scottish to the UK level, where their criticisms of the bill have found a more receptive political audience. This kind of weaponisation of decision-making constraints is no doubt inevitable in any system of constitutionally limited and multi-level government. UK courts, they argued, have shown themselves in the past to be sensitive to this issue. However, Mr. McCorkindale and Ms. McHarg added, as this case makes its way through the courts, we hope that judges will be equally alive to the dangers to Scottish democracy and indeed to the central constitutional purpose of devolution, of allowing policy changes allocated to the devolved level to be too easily overturned by the UK government. They argued that the UK government's reasons for vetoing the bill have taken an expansive view of the scope of a Section 35 order, and that it threatens to render devolved competences which intersect with reserved areas practically unusable, except where Westminster agrees with or is indifferent to the policy. Thus, in seeking judicial review, the Scottish Government will be hoping, even if it does not succeed in invalidating the order, at least to obtain judicial guidance on the proper use of the Section 35 order, and ideally to confine its scope as narrowly as possible, the paper argued. In these circumstances, criticisms that the judicial review is a waste of public money seem misplaced. Mr. McCorkindale and Ms. McHarg also said that the Supreme Court has been historically unsympathetic to arguments grounded in the Democratic Charter of Holyrood, but when sovereignty is not engaged, arguments put forward were regarded as relevant to the legal questions before the court. They added, given that the making of a Section 35 order is not an exercise of sovereign authority, the Scottish Government's arguments founded on democracy, devolution and the separation of powers might find some purchase in describing and limiting the scope and exercise of this executive veto power. Scottish ministers have argued in their submissions that the nature of the reasons given by Mr. Jack to lodge a Section 35 order and the UK's failure to identify changes to make the legislation fit for purpose mean that Westminster's argument is inadequate. The duty requires the Scottish Secretary to address himself to the right question and not to exercise the power on account of mere policy disagreement, Mr. McCorkindale and Ms. McHarg explained. Scottish ministers have argued that the UK's failure to notify them of their concerns in a timely manner and accused Westminster of offering an after-the-event justification for making the decision. The authors pointed out that it will be interesting what disclosure of any documentation behind the decision to make the order will reveal. An article written by Abby Garden-Crosby. The National News on Wednesday, the 26th of April. Tackling long COVID needs urgent action. An article written by Gregor Young. Tackling long COVID stigma needs urgent action from the Scottish Government, a committee report has said, as ministers were urged to establish a single point of contact for sufferers in every health board. The COVID-19 Recovery Committee has published its report on long COVID, outlining a raft of measures for the Scottish Government to improve the condition and awareness of it among healthcare professionals. An estimated 172,000 people in Scotland have self-reported the condition, but there are an estimated 1.9 million cases across the UK. Committee members noted concern in their findings as patients reported being unable to receive a correct diagnosis or proper treatment. Their inquiry, launched in January, focused on awareness and recognition, therapy and rehabilitation. Committee convener Jim Fairley also said he was deeply saddened to learn of the stigma facing those with the debilitating condition. The committee heard from academics, clinicians and those living with long COVID throughout the four-month inquiry. Mr. Fairley said, the report sets out the urgent need for the Scottish Government to take action to address the stigma and lack of awareness surrounding long COVID and to improve the diagnosis and treatment for individuals living with this condition. Throughout the inquiry, we've been deeply saddened and concerned to hear of the stigma being faced by those with lived and living experience of long COVID and the impact this lack of awareness can have on people's mental health and well-being, their education and employment opportunities, and their overall quality of life. The report has led to a number of recommendations, including a single point of contact for long COVID in every health board and a public health campaign to raise awareness of the impact the condition can have. Mr. Fairley added, we've now made several recommendations, including establishing a single point of contact in health boards, increased leadership by the Scottish Government in assessing the effectiveness of long COVID clinics, raising awareness and understanding of the condition, and making better use of health data. The recommendations made in our report must now be acted on to ensure that the stigma associated with long COVID is addressed, enabling those suffering from the condition to receive the recognition and support they both need and deserve. The committee also wants to once again thank all of those who participated in the inquiry and recognise in particular the input from those with experience of the condition whose evidence helped shape this inquiry from the outset and these recommendations to the Scottish Government. An article written by Gregor Young.
From the National, Wednesday 26th of April 2023, from the Culture section. Wait, 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 singer Marty Pelo cancels tour on doctor's orders. Report by Esther Tarnay. The Clydebank star Marty Pelo cancelled the rest of his tour on doctor's orders. The former Wait, Wait, Wait singer announced the sad news on Facebook and said he is deeply disappointed. The post read, "Hi everyone, it is with an incredibly heavy heart that I must announce the cancellation of the Pelo Talk tour. Acting under strict orders from my doctors, I have been instructed not to continue, but to take a period of immediate rest. I am deeply disappointed and truly sorry to have to cancel the tour. My crew and I have been working hard to bring you an unforgettable experience, and it breaks my heart that we won't be able to share it with you. However, I must prioritise my health and listen to my doctor's orders. It's not an easy decision, but it's the right one. Every day I feel a little better, and I promise to do everything in my power to get back to full strength as soon as possible." The 58-year-old recently announced that he would be coming to the ACC Armadillo on Saturday, March the 16th, 2024. The show will be part of his popped-in, sold-out tour, with stops across the UK. And that report was by Esther Tarnay. From the National, Monday the 24th of April, 2023, from the comments section, Steph Payton, aiming target at books as a taste of things to come. By columnist Steph Payton. Anti-intellectualism has been the defining characteristic of far-right and fascist movements through time immemorial. Through Nazi book burnings and McCarthyist crackdowns on anything that might have been in the same room as a communist, progressive movements have often sought to limit our ability to engage openly and honestly with the world around us, and for a simple reason. There is at least a grain of truth in the painted picture of Britain's academics as elitist. The public schoolboy to bumbling First Prime Minister pipeline is a known feature of the United Kingdom's deference to class. But rather than privately educated millionaires like Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson finding themselves the target of so-called anti-elite politics, it is knowledge itself that inevitably comes under attack. No more experts here, thank you very much. Movements that seek to restrict human rights and to protect capital over workers and to mythologize nations will always crumble under scrutiny. And, for that reason, knowledge and understanding will always be enemies to any narrative that claims to have simple answers to complex problems. It's for this reason that public libraries and bookshops often find themselves the targets of moral panics and claims of degeneracy. Nuance and understanding of the world is anathema to the narratives of right-wingers and reactionaries alike. A light that dispels disinformation and campaigns that reassure the public that life really is as simple as they wished it was, where Britain is a perennial force for good in the world, and that those out with the heteronormative nuclear family, or out with in general, are deviants with nefarious intent. Back in 2018, a video of furry activists attacking a socialist bookshop in London was shared around online and has always stuck with me. In it, the furry activists found, in just three titles of the books in display, the justification for their violent assault on free expression. Holding aloft copies of Julia Serrano's Whipping Girl and Robert Verkite's Posh Boys, they screamed about paedophiles and Donald Trump while rampaging through the store. That these books were about, respectively, the means by which femininity is punished and, fittingly, how the English public school system has ruined Britain, did not matter. The material content of the books was irrelevant. Only upset over the imagined proprieties of the title was important. To find offence, willful ignorance and disinterest in the content of the books was necessary. With Britain in the midst of a contemporary manufactured culture war, it seemed inevitable that libraries and bookshops would again find themselves the target of reactionary forces, and recent reporting would suggest that we may be about to see a much anger directed at book lenders in the near future. A recent report claims that a third of UK librarians have been asked to censor and remove books by members of the public while facing threats if they do not bow to the demands. Unsurprisingly, most targeted were books dealing with LGBTQ+ issues, as well as race and the British Empire. All topics that regularly feature in the right-wing press, all topics regularly inflamed and twisted by bad-faith actors. So far along the path to radicalisation are some that when GB News covered the story, the presenters assumed the censorship to be a result of so-called cancel culture rather than, if we're being honest, their own viewers. Though while it is concerning that radicalised members of the public are targeting bookshops and libraries, what I found to be most unsettling was the revelation from the chief executive of Libraries Connected, Isabel Hunter, that while another libraries were facing the same request for censorship, they have been receiving a large number of freedom of information requests, primarily from media organisations. Other than being a waste of time, these requests suggest that Britain's infamously right-wing press have already institutions of learning in their sights. There can be no good that comes from newspapers like the Daily Mail or the Sun rooting around in library catalogues, not when book titles alone are enough to send reactionaries into spittle-flecked rants. The past few years have seen the number of flashpoints over public libraries already, but, given the relentless culture politics at play in the United Kingdom today, a useful scapegoat for the bullies and incompetence of the Conservative Party, I worry that they were only a taste of what may come next. American libraries are already under a full-scale assault from Republicans in the US, while, closer to home, Section 28, the draconian Tory legislation that banned the promotion of homosexuality in the UK, was in part inspired by a widely misreported on-book itself. Jenny Lives with Eric and Martin, a black and white picture book by the Danish author Suzanne Bosch, features a young girl called Jenny living with her dad and his boyfriend. The book faced significant backlash in the press over such scandalous moments as Jenny, her dad and his boyfriend visiting a laundrette together. The fact that an innocent story of a gay couple essentially just spending time with their child was enough to spur the British Parliament into legislating against any book that discussed homosexuality as an example of the hair-triggered reaction that the UK government is capable of when spurred on by the press. In order to function, right-wing movements need to demonise the other, and the most successful means of doing so is through controlling what we learn about those whose experiences differ from our own. And that was an opinion piece by Steph Payton.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Tune Review and tell your friends about our service.